Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. As was tragically brought to light with the murder of Irina Zarudzka, America has a mental health treatment problem. Too many people in need of help are falling through the cracks. Our General Assembly attempted to address that following her murder by passing Irina's law, but even as he signed it, Governor Josh Stein said the bill simply does not do enough to keep you safe. Though it does mandate an initial mental health exam for certain defendants, it does not expand psychiatric beds nor provide funding for treatment. Meanwhile, in South Carolina, the Post and Courier just published a five-part series on the intersection of mental health and criminal justice in the Palmetto State. They found what they describe as a fragmented system marked by gross neglect, costing lives and millions of dollars. Today, a closer look at what the newspaper found and what we might learn from those findings that could aid us in fixing what's broken here. We're joined by two of the reporters who contributed to that series and their editor. Jocelyn Greshick is a watchdog and public service reporter. Alan Hrvorka is a quick response and public safety reporter. And Glenn Smith is deputy managing editor of investigations and public service, all with the Post and Courier. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Morning. Thank you.
So, Glenn, you're the editor. Let me start with you. What led the Post and Courier to devote time and resources to this extensive story?
Well, back in 2024, Alan was covering a case involving a man who had been involved in a series of hatchet attacks that led to the death of one fellow behind a Walmart on James Island here. And in preparing for the case, he came across a psychiatric evaluation, which is normally sealed, that really spelled out this guy's long road through the system of failing to get health, all sorts of interactions along the way with the criminal justice system, with the psychiatric system, with the hospital system. And at no point does he really get the help he needs. And then it just ends tragically for a bunch of people. As we looked a little bit deeper, we found out that the court had failed to seal some 200 records going back over a decade. And we just spent weeks and probably months even, I guess, pulling all those records down, going through them and looking for commonalities. And we really found a supremely dysfunctional system that threatened really the well-being of everyone involved. So we decided it was well worth looking into.
The first article in your series begins with a remarkable sentence. It says, hundreds, this is a quote, hundreds of mentally ill people are languishing for months in South Carolina jails, deprived of needed treatment in a legal purgatory that feeds a cycle of incarceration, despair, and avoidable deaths. I'm not sure which one of you to ask this question of, but did it surprise you? Did you find the situation worse as you got deeper into the story than you anticipated? Glenn, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, we discovered that over 100 inmates had died, mentally ill inmates had died since 2015 in South Carolina jails, often while waiting to get into the state's lone psychiatric hospital for treating criminal defendants. We just saw people just in awful despair in these facilities and the people trying to watch over them struggling as well. It just seemed a system in major disrepair. It was shocking.
Alan, Glenn mentioned that this all started with a story you reported on and then expanded out. And you we'll talk about this treasure trove of documents that you unanticipatedly had access to in a moment, but how did you report this story? Who did you talk to in the course of events?
Yeah, I mean, I think like any good story, it starts with a tip. And I got a tip that there was going to be a murder case dismissal or, you know, some sort of disposition that was going to be happening. At the time, I wasn't super sure what was happening. So I go down to the courthouse. I meet with, the prosecutor. I see the victim's family and I see the defense attorney. And I'm not allowed to go in the courtroom because I learned it's an involuntary commitment. So I go downstairs and that's when I find the records. And so through that process, you know, I pour through the records, I talk to the family, and, you know, I talk to prosecutors. They're not super keen on talking to me about the case. And then, you know, I reach out to the public defender's office, and then, you know, they tried to file an injunction to prevent us from publication. And that sort of also set off some alarm bells of, hey, this is, maybe there's something here.
So if they're filing an injunction because they don't want this information in a newspaper that's published statewide, Jocelyn, you do a lot of reporting about conditions in jails and conditions of inmates, et cetera, and you speak to some people in law enforcement. Did you find them to be cooperative, or did you have to pick and choose very carefully who you spoke with?
Yes and no. I think this was an interesting project to undertake because I think we quickly all found that, unlike some of the other things we've covered in the past, a lot of people agreed, you know, no matter who it was they worked for, whether it was the prosecutor's office or the sheriff's office, you know, in the courthouse, you know, we spoke with judges, experts as well. They all kind of come to a consensus that this is a real big problem. And there's a lot of agreement on that. I think where we saw less of an agreement was how exactly the state should tackle this crisis. So yeah, I think there was, I think we found a general willingness from, yeah, pretty much everyone we spoke with to really engage on this issue because it really touches all of their respective jobs and lives in some way, shape, or form.
Glenn, you've already mentioned that you had access to documents that you didn't anticipate having access to, and it, you kind of stumbled upon, or your reporters stumbled upon, a treasure trove of unsealed records which the court had failed to seal. What did this quirk of fate allow you to do that perhaps you could not have done in the absence of those records, and why didn't they seal them?
Well, that the last part of that question is a really good question, and they've been rather evasive, I guess, on answering who was responsible and why. It seems it was an oversight some years ago and did not come to light until we found this. I think what it gave us was a real rare window into this world and how it functions, how people come into the criminal justice system, often with documented long histories of treatment. I mean, there was one guy we saw who his family had called mobile crisis for help with him 87 times over a period of a few years. Another guy who had been in the emergency room over 70 times, and he'd often, they'd stabilize him, put him back on the street, get in trouble, stabilize him, put him back on the street. Eventually he's in the criminal justice system, stuck in the jail. Jail's not ready to, really prepared to care for these folks. And it, you just see this vicious cycle just chewing people up on all ends. And I think those reports that we saw gave us a real, like I said, rare view into this world and documented all their steps along this path.
You report that your team's review of records gave you a, quote, unexpected window into a dysfunctional, costly, and at times inhumane system whose failings are normally kept hidden from the public. Why? Are the only people that know about this the on the front lines of this stuff in the criminal justice system, in the jails? And do you think your story, which is five parts, will have an impact on changing that? Other people now know about this.
Yeah, I mean, there's a state law that basically, and federal laws too, that prevent some of this stuff from being released to the public. But you see these conditions described, people like just allowed to, you know, dying from dehydration, wallowing in their own filth, completely decompensating and getting worse and worse and worse as they wait months and months behind bars for some kind of help. I think putting that out there and telling these individual stories, we're certainly hopeful that there will be some impact coming from this. We've heard some rumblings, but haven't seen any solid action yet.
I think you can answer this. I don't know that you can, Glenn, but is South Carolina an outlier, or is it just part of a system that's duplicated across the country? The same. If you reported this story in Idaho, would we have the same, would the same facts come out?
Yeah, I think unfortunately, it's not so much of an outlier. It's a problem across the country. I think 16 states, I believe, have been sued so far in class action suits. for failing to violating people's constitutional rights by keeping them behind bars without help and access to a speedy trial. And other states, I think, though, have done more. I think Washington State, for one, as a result of a lawsuit, has spent like $2 billion adding additional psychiatric beds and programs. Colorado's got a whole new revamp of a system to help navigate people through the systems. South Carolina's pretty much just sat on its hands during this period. Hmm.
Jocelyn, as is the case with many situations in the state of North Carolina, some of these individuals are deemed too sick to stand trial, too mentally ill to stand trial. They're not competent. That's a good thing, that you wouldn't put somebody who's incompetent on the stand and make them go to trial for a crime they may have committed or may not have committed. But like in this state, there is insufficient space within the psychiatric system in South Carolina, so they end up in the county jails. How long are they usually there?
So our average wait time for that treatment to restore them to stand trial currently stands at about 8 months. And that is from the moment our state office of mental health receives an order from a judge to, you know, basically okay this treatment. And so that 8 month average does not include the time it might take for that original hearing to be scheduled where it's decided that they need treatment. It does not include the time it could take for the judge to actually send the order to the state office of mental health. We found in reviewing our records that we, you know, uncovered, sometimes that period from the judge issuing the order to sending it to the state office of mental health, sometimes that in and of itself could take months. And so the 8 month average is actually, it could be like way higher because of all these other factors. And then our state law allows for up to 6 months of treatment time. And we've found that, you know, 9 times out of 10, the state needs to take that full 180 days to try and restore them to stand trial. So when you add it up all together, it's a long time that these defendants are going through this process.
In fact, Alan, you report that many of these people end up serving time in jail for longer periods than the maximum sentence would have cost them had they been convicted. And these people have not yet been convicted, and many die in jail. You report that in the last decade, I think 102 mentally ill people have died in South Carolina jails. Why? Are they not getting proper supervision? What's happening there that these folks are dying in the jails?
I mean, it's a range of factors, right? So, and one of them has to do with medication over objection. So if someone is out in the world and they are medicated and then all of a sudden they end up in the jail for some reason or another, and they're normally being administered certain drugs, and now they are not, and you go cold turkey on some of these things, it causes a major disruption in their condition. And often the response to manage that condition is to place them in isolation, which only exacerbates their condition. Sometimes it has to do with short staffing in jails, and we've also seen indications of dysfunction between the private medical care providers and county public workers.
And I would assume that part of the problem is there are not enough mental health care workers who are experts in the medical side of the treatment to be in attendance at all times to help these people out. We'll talk more about that and other aspects of this five-part series that was published recently in the Post and Courier, Caught in the Cycle. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. As part of the middle school Think Lab curriculum, students engage in hands-on, project-based learning focused on real-world problems. Information at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about a five-part series about mental illness and its intersection with the criminal justice system in South Carolina that was conducted recently by the Post and Courier called Caught in the Cycle. Alan Havorka is one of the reporters, along with Jocelyn Greshek, who reported on this, an extensive series, and Glenn Smith is the Deputy Managing Editor of Investigations and Public Service for the Post and Courier. I just mentioned a second ago, Glenn, that 102 people over the last 10 years, mentally ill people, have died in South Carolina jails while awaiting treatment and trial. In one case, you write that the individual, quote, died after rotting for months in a filthy Charleston County jail cell while awaiting treatment, and that the county coroner drew a direct line to the system's failures, ruling his death in 1922 a, quote, homicide from gross medical neglect. A homicide. Was anyone held responsible, Glenn?
No. No, and she's ruled that way a couple times. Alan could probably, he's talked to the coroner a little bit about her theories behind that. He could probably extrapolate on that. But in this case, no. I mean, they found this guy. He was unresponsive, died shortly after, at a local hospital from organ failure. He just basically, like a number of folks there, just died in plain sight.
Alan, you want to expand on that?
Yeah, you know, I'm struck by what, you know, Bobby Joe O'Neill had, you know, sort of told me over a couple of different conversations, and that her homicide designations, in her mind, are typically indications of a public health crisis, whether that is either through negligent healthcare. You know, think about like an assisted nursing facility, and if a resident there dies because they have, you know, really bad bed sores, like the kind that you have, you know, stage four. She's drawn those kinds of, you know, comparisons. And in other cases, you know, it's just been, she's been saying that for the last few years, even though there's been a open federal investigation, we keep repeating ourselves, whether it's D'Angelo Brown, Mary Percato, so on and so forth, unfortunately.
Why, you used the term filthy, Charleston County jail cell. Why filthy? It's the largest, and you say later, largest and arguably best equipped detention center in the state. Why are the conditions deplorable?
So people are just allowed to lie in their own waste. And
why?
That's a really good question. And it's been a problem for many years, and not just in this jail here. I mean, I did a series back in 2007 where I spent months in the Charleston County Jail. And at the time, the jail administrator took me around to see some of these folks. And there was one guy who was so sick, he couldn't be allowed to wear clothes or have bedding on his bed. And he would wash his dinner every night in the toilet. The picture is in the series, this one here. And you know, he said, we're not equipped to deal with this stuff. We're not psychiatric care workers. We have no training in this. And, you know, when I went back to him this time around, he said, you know, if this sort of thing was, if Americans were trapped in a foreign country like this, the way we treat the mentally ill, we'd be sending troops in to rescue them. And that's somebody who runs the jail.
Mm. Jocelyn, there are a lot of examples in this five-part series that we will touch on as we go through the hour. But the common thread simply that these are people who have mental health conditions, who desperately need mental health treatment, but there's not enough of that available, and they're caught up in this system that they can't seem to get out of. It's a cycle. That's why you call the series "Caught in the Cycle." Or are there other common threads that run through who these people are?
Yeah, certainly. I think in the 200 plus cases we really dug into, we noticed several common themes. Drug and alcohol use was very common among these individuals. Lifetimes of adversity was very common because these psychiatric evaluations do a very thorough job of the social workers and the psychiatrists who prepare them and interview the defendants. They'll really dig into the defendant's past if they're able to. And so, you know, we read about childhood trauma. Many come from families of dysfunction, of divorce, of homicide, suicide. A lot of them dropped out of school at a very young age. And, you know, experts I spoke with said this, you know, oftentimes, and this is not unique in South Carolina, but oftentimes people who are mentally ill, they end up seeing a police officer before they'll ever see a psychiatrist. And so that we found often starts this cycle that they're just
Does race or poverty play a role?
Certainly, yeah. The vast majority of these people were Black men, which, you know, that's not, we know that generally that's kind of reflective of broader trends in America. But, and then also all of them, most of them had public defenders, which signaled to us that they were, yeah, impoverished.
Alan, this is not a problem that is unique to South Carolina, as we've already talked about this, but you do say that this is a system in a state of crisis in dire need of repair. But we've also talked about how people are wondering how to do it, that they don't really have a fix in mind for this. It's not a new problem. It's been going on for decades, perhaps a century or more. Why? Why isn't the answer fairly clear to people, not just in South Carolina, but around the country who deal with this? Alan.
Yeah. I think at its core is deinstitutionalization and the question of, these folks do have civil rights. They do have constitutionally, jails are required to provide a constitutionally minimally adequate care to these folks. And it is really hard to balance where that line is sometimes. You can't hold someone in a facility forever.
Right. In 2024, South Carolina commissioned, the state commissioned, a report which concluded that the Palmetto State had the most fragmented health and human services structure in the nation, with 8 independent agencies supervising various aspects of mental health and 3 times fewer mental health facilities per capita than other states, and a below average supply of psychologists. Not a good mix. Has anything come of that report, Alan? Any changes been made?
I think Jocelyn would probably be best
okay.
to answer that one.
Jocelyn?
Yeah, I dug into the report a little bit. This was commissioned by our governor a couple years ago after, this has been a kind of a common refrain for years in South Carolina. We had this super, sporadic healthcare system when compared to other states. And so a lot of governors in the past had made this push to consolidate. And so the state finally got it done a couple years ago. And then the governor wanted to take a deeper look at just the overall healthcare system. And so, yes, to answer your question, there have been a couple changes as a result of those findings. We've expanded access to mental health care in schools. They made it a little bit more flexible for the public school system to be able to hire school counselors and that sort of thing. And the biggest change, I think, was the state chose to funnel a pretty large sum of money to our Health and Human Services Department, which of course is responsible for administering Medicaid and Medicare. And they partnered with a lot of private hospitals to build these psychiatric diversion programs. So kind of with the goal of diverting people in mental health crisis away from emergency rooms and into these specialized units. So I would say those are some of the big changes that come to mind.
And they're fairly recent. Is there any way to measure that it's had any impact yet, or is it too soon to tell?
I think it's too soon to tell. I think there are about 13 of those units in hospitals that I mentioned, and I'm not sure if all of them are even online yet. There might only be a couple that are up and running. And then there's only been, I didn't mention this, but the Health and Human Services Agency also funneled money to hospitals to build new psychiatric hubs, so more inpatient bed space, which I think is a good thing, but only one of those is up and running. And I think there's plans to add another one in the upstate region.
As one of you pointed out, some of these people get released because they're deemed unfit to stand trial, or they are sentenced to time served while they were waiting trial, etc. So some of these people commit serious crimes. So there's a cost to society for that. There's a cost in terms of lives wasted by these people who are suffering mental conditions, who need help and might be able to recover if they got that help. And of course, there's a cost, a monetary cost to all this, because we're housing people, you're housing people in jails that aren't really helping the situation. They're just prolonging the problem. So do we know what the monetary price tag is of this in South Carolina?
I would say one quick thing to look at would be the $25 million we've spent over the past few years on wrongful death lawsuits that have come out of incidents in the jails, and that's probably an undercount. They also have, jail officials have said basically it costs roughly $104 a day to house an inmate in the Charleston County Jail. It costs about three times that much to house a mentally ill inmate. Many of them are in there for years at a time by the time they go through the process. We looked at one guy who an estimate put him up in the hundreds of thousands of dollars just to care for this one guy. So yeah, there's a real cost, and they've been reluctant to spend money on the treatment side, the preventative side. I mean, Mike, you've driven on our roads as you cross over from Charlotte. You've seen how much we like to spend money. Yes, we don't.
Your roads are far better than ours. We're envious.
Oh, yeah. I beg to differ, but anyway, yeah. So they haven't spent much money on the preventative side, but it's cost a good deal on the back end.
There's another cost. It's the cost to victims. As these mentally ill folks are languishing in the, what you call a purgatory of the system, the victims are deprived of justice and closure, and they sometimes feel, as you have written, that they've been forgotten or they're unable to get information about their alleged perpetrator's situation because of privacy laws. And you quote a victim of gun violence allegedly committed by someone deemed mentally ill as saying, it's like there's no public admittance, there's no written acknowledgement that he almost killed me and he changed my life. Would that be substantially different if there were sufficient mental health resources either before or after a crime like that was committed? I'm not sure which one of you can take that.
I can talk about that. Yeah, I think that's a hard question to answer because it's a what if, you know. I think it's certainly possible, you know, that if I was actually talking with someone yesterday who kind of described this situation as a river, and if someone with a mental illness falls in at the beginning of the river where it's really shallow, it's a lot easier to pull them out. But when they float downstream to where it's really deep and, you know, there might be rapids and whatnot, it's a lot harder to pull them out. And so the analogy is like, if we kind of what Glenn was saying, if we did spend more money on the treatment side of things, perhaps it would be a lot easier to pull those people out.
Does anybody know if more money was spent on the treatment side, if this would actually be less costly to taxpayers? Because I think when you add up what it costs per day in the Charleston County Jail to house somebody, over time, it's in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Would it be cheaper to get them mental health care and put them in a psychiatric facility while they're getting it?
I think almost certainly, because we know that inpatient psychiatric care is by far the most expensive way to treat someone. And so if you are spending more money on the treatment side of things, you know, perhaps you're providing more and, you know, expanded outpatient treatment access, and that's a lot cheaper.
So why aren't they doing it? You're a Republican-controlled state and they like to save taxpayer money. Why aren't they doing it?
Yeah, I think I can answer that. I think I'll go to a quote from Judge Roger Young, and the first part is that you know, these folks are the least sympathetic constituency in the state, and there are, you know, there's a lot of money out there, but there are also a lot of people competing for that money when the state house is in session. You know, I'll go back to that $25 million figure. You know, a prosecutor remarked to me that was $25 million that could have been spent. $25 million from taxpayers, a lot of it's paid out through the insurance revenue fund, that could have been spent on mental health care or community health care on the front end. And then there's all sorts of shadow costs, right? There's the cost to have the private medical care provider in the jail. And so much of their contract has to do with behavioral health. And that's $7.4 million a year.
Wow. The U.S. Constitution, Alan, guarantees the right to a speedy trial in every criminal case, both federal and state. And that's pretty vague. What constitutes speedy? So Congress in 1974 passed the Speedy Trial Act to set a clear set of federal deadlines. Indictment within 30 days of arrest, trial within 70 days of indictment or arraignment. Given the amount of time that these people that you reported on spend awaiting medical help prior to trial, is what the state of South Carolina doing in violation of that law, and is it unconstitutional what they're doing? Is the state in any jeopardy as a result?
So I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but public defenders would say yes, and they would but also prosecutors would be quick to point out the state does not have its own speedy trial statute like states like Pennsylvania. And in fact, getting a judge to toss out a case for a speedy trial violation is really hard. And I've only heard of it a couple times. And there was one case in Beaufort County, and that was only after there was some issues with between the prosecutor and the judge.
Another part of this cycle is the number of time that these people have been charged and fined throughout their lives. Your team, Jocelyn, found that 206 of these defendants had been charged or fined 6,000 times during their lives, or an average of about 30 charges each. What kind of crimes have they been charged with, and why, after all those charges and presumably some convictions, why are they on the streets committing new crimes?
The second part of that question is very challenging to answer. But the majority of these crimes, we noticed a lot of it was petty activity like shoplifting, lots of drug use, lots of trespassing, public drunkenness, basically disorderly conduct, you know, sort of those sorts of things.
But the potential is there for more serious crimes, and some people who have been out and committed these serious crimes, who were part of this cycle of going back in and coming back out, have caused serious injury to people, and there's a cost of that as well. We're talking about the Post and Courier five-part series Caught in the Cycle about mental ill treatment or the lack of it in South Carolina and how the jails are picking up the slack and not doing a very good job because that's not their job in the first place. We'll come back and talk more about it in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about a series, a five-part series in the Post and Courier called Caught in the Cycle, about mental ill patients who get lost in the system of being put in jail while they wait to mental health evaluation and or treatment before going to trial in situations that are not equipped to deal with them. And the cost of all of that, mental, physical, to victims, to the perpetrators, to the system at large, and to the taxpayer. It's a series reported by Jocelyn Greshick and Alan Havorka with the Post and Courier, and the editor of the story and the deputy managing editor of Investigations Public Service is Glenn Smith. They're all three with us this morning. Glenn, you found some cases in which a defendant, after committing a serious crime like manslaughter, underwent several rounds of mental health evaluations, got out, committed another serious crime, even pleading guilty to manslaughter, and then serving a short sentence and being released to community service and then returning to jail, accused of stabbing his sister and two others. How do you explain that? This mystifies a lot of people, and it's not exclusive to South Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, in some cases, I think you see over time all these interactions with the justice system. It sort of, over time, propels people to more dangerous behavior. As you say, 200 people charged 6,000 times. And then when you get out, if it's an involuntary commitment, this, I know the prosecutors are quite troubled by this, it's not the same as not guilty by reason of insanity, in which somebody is monitored closely once they get out. They're often put out, and the probate courts, which oversee them, don't really have a monitoring mechanism or great enforcement of that. So people deteriorate again and potentially encounter somebody and things go really, really wrong.
Yeah. Jocelyn, you also say that your investigation found dozens of defendants who bounced back and forth between your state's criminal justice and mental health systems without receiving long-term care. And it strikes me, and there's no pun intended here, that that is the very definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And what's even more confounding is an observation that you write about by Ninth Circuit Solicitor Scarlett Wilson, who is frustrated by a system that she says leaves those in need of mental health treatment on the street because they're not competent to stand trial. You quote her as saying, "You're telling me that this person is okay enough to be let out, to live alone, to run their everyday life, but they're not competent to stand trial? That does not compute to me. Does it to anyone you spoke with?"
I think you'd be hard pressed to find someone who it does make sense to. But yeah, it's kind of like what Glenn was just saying, it's this sort of weird legal scenario where they, you know, constitutionally they're protected from being tried because they're not competent, but you know, the state can't just hold them forever because that is against the law too. And so it's kind of the scenario of what do you do with them? You have to release them.
Is the law insufficient? Does there need to be a law that governs what happens to people who are not mentally competent to stand trial, but who have allegedly committed a crime and may do so again if they're set free? I mean, shouldn't they be given treatment by law?
So the law allows them to be treated up until the maximum punishment for the crime they were accused of committing. So in, you know, like a murder case, that would presumably be for a very long time that legally they could be held. However, the state hospital where the person's being held and being treated has to constantly evaluate, does this person meet the standard for commitment, which is, are they, you know, a risk of harming themselves or others? And once they no longer meet that threshold, the state hospital, you know, argues to release them. So that's kind of where you get some discrepancy.
And there's all sorts of pressure on the state hospital. We have one public forensic psychiatric hospital with 213 beds. And those folks are treating these involuntary commitment folks. They're also forced to provide the restoration treatment for those who've been unfit to stand trial. Big waiting list, all this pressure to move people through and to get people out of that system. So, I mean, that plays a factor too.
I want to come back to that in a second, but Glenn, you say that even when the system is applied the way it was intended, it, quote, revolves around competency restoration, but is not designed to comprehensively manage defendants' underlying illnesses, which often include schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, nor is it intended to better their lives and put them on a path to be functional citizens. If the system isn't designed for that, what is it designed for?
It's designed to get them well enough to punish them. It's designed to have them understand the legal process that they're involved in so they can say the judge does this, the prosecutor does that, and to let them stand trial.
If these people were mentally ill when they committed the crime, it is true, I think, it can be proven by mental health experts, that sometimes you're doing things that you would not normally do if you were mentally ill. Should they be punished?
That's a good question. Alan had one particular case involving a police chief and a guy who's out now working as a security guard after biting the chief's ear off. I mean, it sort of plays out in cases like that, where I think people are, the case you've heard to earlier that Jocelyn spoke to, the woman who was the victim in that who got shot was a trained therapist. And she could understand all the psychological underpinnings of that case and be sympathetic, but at the same time says, you know, where's the recognition for what I've gone through, the fact that I have lingering lifelong injuries? And so, I mean, it's very debatable point.
Alan, the article in which you talk about the man who bit the sheriff's ear off, you talk to that person who is now working as a security guard. Clearly, he got one hopes, help. And he says to you in that article, if I'm not mistaken, that he would never have had done, we would never have done that to the sheriff had he been in his right mind, correct?
Correct. And I think it's worth noting that, so that incident was 6 years ago now. And, you know, that individual also had been receiving treatment for his schizoaffective disorder up until the day of the attack, but that treatment had lapsed. And when he was in crisis and he showed up at his local OMH community mental health center, they turned him away. His records don't say exactly why, but him and his attorney both said it was because he showed up and he was belligerent, but he was also, you know, spiraling into psychosis. And that's sort of, you know, that was the day before he attacked the police chief.
And we hear that kind of story a lot. People seeking help or family members reporting them and asking them to give their family member help. And then they're turned away for one reason or another. For those who receive treatment, a lot of people in your state go to the Lone Forensic Psychiatric Hospital that Glenn mentioned a minute ago, the G. Werber Bryan Hospital in Columbia, which has a waiting list of 165 people for a facility with only 213 beds, and that's the same number of beds, evidently, that it's had for decades, even as South Carolina's population has exploded. How do you explain, Alan, how does anybody explain the lack of expansion?
Well, I think that might start venturing into politics, and that's outside of my realm of expertise. But I think what Jocelyn's reporting would show is that for decades there has been an underinvestment and cutting of resources for DMH, yeah. And that even before the population boom, the agency was not receiving adequate funding.
Jocelyn, you quote a public defender, Cameron Blazer, who told you, quote, "I don't care how fiscally conservative you are. Every dollar we spend on mental health is $1 we save on jails, on prosecutions, on property loss from theft, on the devastating effects of interpersonal violence and crime that occurs in the crucible of mental illness that is untreated or unchecked." Pretty strong words. Have you been able to verify that claim that it saves a dollar, every dollar spent saves a dollar on incarceration?
No, we haven't been able to necessarily prove that specifically, but I think it's, you know, the sentiment is certainly supported by what we were discussing earlier about, you know, if we can provide more intervention on the front end before situations start to spiral into true crises, then we can save perhaps more money on the back end.
The history of mental health treatment, probably around the world, but certainly in this country, has not been a good one. And I think South Carolina had one of the earlier mental health facilities dating way back centuries. In the 50s and in years prior to that, mentally ill people were treated at state-owned psychiatric hospitals. That was the case in South Carolina. Many people languished there as well and didn't get the required or the proper care. And in recent years, that care was shifted to community-based organizations because it was considered more humane. But the reality that you report, Glenn, is that much of the burden in caring for the most severely ill shifted to county jails and state prisons, which became de facto asylums. Could it be argued that what has happened is even worse than what came before?
Boy, that would be, I mean, it was pretty grim before in the asylums, but certainly I think the investment that was supposed to follow into community programs and outreach really didn't materialize. So again, the prisons back in 2014 were the subject in South Carolina of a class action lawsuit, in which the state had to spend millions to rectify all sorts of mistreatment of mentally ill folks who were held in solitary confinement for months, years in some case, subjected to all sorts of bad treatment there. They've made remarkable progress. The jails are now sort of the landscape that needs to be addressed, but there just doesn't seem to be the will or the money to get that done.
Alan, you spoke to a lot of people who work in the jails. These are people who are on the front lines trying to take care of these people who should be patients in facilities and who don't have the training to take care of them, really. What are you hearing from them about what it's like to work in those conditions, Alan?
It is exhausting. You know, there are folks who go in there. Some of them do know what they're getting into, and they go in there with, you know, a positive, I'm going to kind of make a difference kind of thing, being, you know, like a good civil servant kind of attitude, people that we want serving in public government. And then there are folks who take the job and they have no idea what they're getting into. And it's just, it's brutal. I mean, how many times would you, you know, be able to stand having feces thrown at you before you, you know, quit? Right. You know, you want to talk about why there's a shortage there? I mean,
let me ask you, because you like political questions, let me ask you another one. South Carolina has tried to break this cycle. Legislators decided that since mental health resources were lacking, they would bring help to the jails, as opposed to taking the inmates to another facility. But according to your reporting, 4 years after they made that decision, the effort stalled because of a lack of funding and buy-in by members of the legislature. And in fact, only one jail in that program has succeeded at this, in Aiken County, South Carolina. You report that program has saved $2.5 million and shaved 6,240 days, or a staggering 17 years off the time that defendants spend in jail waiting for their cases to be resolved, and yet the legislature has failed to fund this expansion to other jails. They passed the legislation. Why not fund it? What's their excuse?
It's a great question, but it's a common theme here, both in North Carolina, South Carolina, and even Florida. Florida has been very innovative in treating folks in this, you know, area of our society. And Florida, Florida's governor signed a bill, you know, basically encouraging or forcing counties and local governments to adopt the Miami model. I won't go into what that entails, but it's really proven stuff. They didn't attach any funding to it. It's good stuff, but there's no money. Hmm. So your guess is as good as mine, I guess.
Your report, Glenn, states that there are states that are making serious strides in improving mental health. You just mentioned Florida. Others include Colorado, Washington State, Illinois, Kentucky. What are some of the things that they are doing that might be applied to your state or even to North Carolina? What are they doing?
Well, like say Washington State, again, is a result of a lawsuit. They've added hundreds of additional psychiatric beds, but also a number of outpatient treatment centers. States like Washington and Colorado have also added folks that serve as like navigators in the system, who can early in the process identify folks who might be diverted to different programs instead of going to jail, which might make them worse. The Miami model is very similar to that as well, trying to keep as many people out of jail and in treatment as possible, and to give them help in finding housing, employment, whatever their needs might be that are causing them to fail. It's interesting to note, just this week a report came out in Charleston County looking at the jail population, and the jail population is now at a 10-year high, at the same time that crime across the board has been going down for years. And you look at the offenses people are going in for, with the exception of DUI, most of them are trespassing, disorderly conduct, public drunkenness. It's our crowd. It's this crowd we're writing about here, costing taxpayers money. There aren't a whole lot of alternatives to funnel them into a different system, and we're reaping the result right now.
You quote Neil Gowan-Smith, who's a forensic psychologist, who told you that your state's struggles reflect, quote, the nation's dysfunctional mental health system. And he adds that he thinks we as a country have abdicated our responsibility to people with mental illness, away from people with licenses, and toward people with badges. I'm curious, in those states that are doing something about this, and I have literally 15 seconds, is it costing them less? Is crime going down?
Good question. I think it's too early to tell in some cases, but I think that the indications are yes.
Glenn Smith is the Deputy Managing Editor of Investigations and Public Service at the Post and Courier. He helped them win a Pulitzer Prize on another series of stories earlier in his career. Jocelyn Greshick and Alan Havorka are both reporters for the Post and Courier who worked on this five-part series, Caught in the Cycle. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.